Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out all the articles and the other sections of the website, like Craft of Preaching. I mean, if you're a pastor and you're using the lectionary, you got to be using Craft of Preaching. You get some exegesis by some people like John Pless and Robert Kolb. I mean, you're really not doing yourself any favors if you're not taking advantage of that. Chad and I we're in the quarantine technically, but we're also in the states that are like, hey, let's give it a shot and see what happens. And so I don't have any data for you other than we're right at the beginning of giving this thing a shot. And so far, it's okay. So far, I haven't seen anything horrible happen yet, Chad.
No, so far we're safe and sound here in Texas. We'll see what happens. My wife actually went back to work today.
Oh,
she's been off for oh my goodness, what do we figure? 7 weeks, mm-hmm. I guess. So she's going back part time. So we'll see how it goes. She's a dental hygienist, so they're like dressing as if they're going into open heart surgery.
Yeah,
so it's gonna definitely be a change for her.
She's got like a hazmat suit on. She's like, looks like one of those doctors from the movie Outbreak.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see how it goes.
So last week, Chad, we finished the story of Samson, the best known of all the characters and stories in the book of Judges. And but we're not through Judges yet, so it doesn't end with the sort of paramount story. We got some lesser known things to finish up before we're out of this book.
Yeah, we're kind of in the final section here. There's still a few chapters to go. We're at chapter 17. And yeah, it's kind of a different flavor to the rest of for the rest of the book, because yeah, we're kind of done with Judges at this point. I mean, the actual Judges, even though when we get to Samuel, he is the final judge, you might say. But we're entering into new territory here, because what seems to take place in 17 and following is there's much more of a focus upon individual families and kind of using what happened with them as examples of what was happening in the broader society. So Samson, yeah, he's the judge that we hear the most about, and kind of the, depending on your perspective, either the climax or the anticlimax of the Judges,
maybe both,
the top or the bottom, a little
both,
above,
both things can be true at once.
Yeah, right. So we're going to shift now in chapter 17 especially to a focus on an individual family and a couple of members of that family and this strange Levite fellow that shows up on the doorstep. So it's 17 and 18 are really just a fascinating journey into the lives of some families, as well as one of the tribes, the tribe of Dan, and how there's kind of this strange mixture of talk about Yahweh, but then idol worship, and this Levite who basically is an opportunist who hires himself out to whoever can pay him the most to do his sacrificing and consulting of the gods. So it's really, I love the chapters, because not because it's full of all kinds of good stuff. I mean, it's full of all kinds of idolatry and heterodoxy, but just, I think even on a psychological level, it just shows how mixed up people were. They were trying to combine talk of Yahweh with the construction of idols. And so it's this kind of theological, rampant theological confusion that characterized this, not just this period, of course, but a lot of periods of Israel's history. So anyway, we'll get right into it. Starts out 17, verse 1, that there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. Stop there for just a second. So two things ought to jump out of us. One, we can see, and the one is kind of hidden in the Hebrew. So we've heard a couple of different times about the Ephraimites. We heard about them in connection with Gideon, and we heard about them in connection with Jephthah, I believe it was, chapter 8 and chapter 12. And remember, those were the guys that like were itching to fight.
Yeah.
You know, they were upset with Gideon first, and then he kind of pacified them. But when they were upset with Jephthah was just like, I'll show you, right? And we had this big massacre at the crossing of the Jordan with the Ephraimites.
Yeah, you need this text just to lets you know that he didn't completely exterminate them.
Right. Yeah. They weren't all wiped out. There were some left. But as soon as we hear that there was a man in the hill country of Ephraim, we're like, uh-oh, this, if we're going to judge what's about to happen based upon what's already happened, this is probably not going to be that uplifting of a story. So that's the first thing to note. And the second is this guy's name. I checked, I don't know, 10 or 12 translations, and every single one of them translated as transliterated rather as Micah, which is, I mean, close, but not exact. So here's what happens in chapter 17 and 18. The first two occurrences of this guy's name in Hebrew is Mikayehu. And then after that, it's a shortened form of Micah. Now, why is this important? Well, I think what's going on here, well, let me explain first of all what the name means, and then I'll explain what's going on. So the first two occurrences in verse 1 and then verse 4 is Mikayehu, and that's really composed of three different Hebrew words that are put together. Mi, Ka, and then Yehu. So Mi and Ka mean something like who is like. And then the ending element of his name, Yehu, is a short form of Yahweh. So Mikayehu is basically who is like Yahweh. So you hear his name in the Hebrew and you're like, ah, this guy must be, you know, a faithful worshiper of Yahweh. He's got what's called a theophoric element to his name, meaning there's like a God element to his name. But then when after that, after you're introduced to him, then the rest of the time his name is written as Micah. So the God element, the Yahweh element drops off, which actually is quite fitting when you read the story itself, because you realize this guy is super messed up theologically, and he's trying to do this syncretistic mixing of Yahweh's name with all sorts of idol worship. So anyway, I point that out because right in the opening verses, you know, there's a couple of elements to the story that are hinted at, the Ephraimites and then this guy's name. So what's going on with him? Well, he says to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. And then he returns the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, which, by the way, was a bunch of money. And his mother said, I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord. Now that is Yahweh, to Yahweh. So I wholly dedicate the silver to Yahweh for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I return them to you. Now, this gets even better because listen to verse 4. So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. Let me go ahead and finish the next two verses. And the man Micah had a shrine. Literally, he had a house of God, Beit Elohim. He had a shrine or some little temple or something like that. And he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. And then it wraps up. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes.
This is a bizarre story, because
this is extremely strange story.
So, you know, we don't know anything about this 1,100 pieces of silver, at least not that I know of. This is a weird way to do that, where it's like, hey, you know that money that was stolen from you, Mom? It was me. And now I'm going to give it back to you. And she's like, oh, well, just praise the Lord for you.
Praise be to God. Yeah.
What kind of situation is this?
There's like so many levels of bizarreness to this story. I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be one thing if you're like, hey, you know that 1,100 pieces of silver that were stolen? I found that guy. I got it back. I don't know, maybe that's what happened. I mean, I guess it's possible. But it seems like he says that he's the one that took it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, he took it. And I suspect maybe he brought it back because she uttered some kind of curse and he heard it. And he's like, uh-oh, you know. So he wasn't the most God-fearing man in the Yahweh sort of sense. But maybe he was scared about this curse. He's like, oh, man, made Mom mad. She said, curse would be the one who stole my silver. I better take it back.
Yeah.
And but she doesn't even seem upset. She's like happy.
No, she rewards him.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But that's one of the another odd thing about this. So, yeah, she rewards him, and she says, oh, great, you know, so I'm going to dedicate all the silver, completely dedicate this silver to the Lord, to Yahweh. And how is she going to dedicate it to Yahweh? She's going to have her son make an idol.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of a Mount Sinai situation all over again, you know, because they make this golden calf, and then Aaron says, oh, tomorrow we're having a festival to Yahweh. This is just the almost predictable pattern of the Israelites, where the element of the commandments about not making an image for Yahweh, it's just ignored repeatedly, a flagrant ignoring of it. So, you kind of want to get in their heads, like, what are they thinking? I mean, are they understanding these idols to be representatives of Yahweh? Or are they just kind of putting Yahweh together with other gods in this mixed up pantheon that's going on here in Canaan? What are they thinking? And then another element of this is kind of strange. Okay, she dedicates the silver, right, to Yahweh, but then she takes only 200 of the pieces of silver to give them to the silversmith. Well, what happened to the other 900 pieces of silver? We're never told. So did she decide she's going to keep that, or what happened? Anyway, a lot of unanswered and unanswerable questions, I suppose, going on here. But there's plenty that we do know. We know that this guy, whose name is Mikayehu, who was like Yahweh, well, he's a thief. He's dishonored his mom, stealing from her. And now he's about to take this silver, at least a portion of it, dedicated to Yahweh, and make a graven image out of it. And he's not going to stop there. He's got his own little shrine, little temple that he has set up. And now that he has this idol, I guess he decides, well, you know what? I need a priest. I've got a son. I'll just do this little home ordination, and he can be my priest, and he can serve this idol, and everything will be just great, because I'll have kind of a good luck charm in my home.
Dude, I mean, is there anything that we have read thus far in the Old Testament that sounds more like you are cooking up a cult than this?
No, I don't think that we have. Yeah, that's a great way to view this. I mean, he is going down the path of self-determination here, right? He is going to decide exactly what he wants his religion to look like. He's going to choose his own priest, do his own home ordination, have his own little household shrine. Yeah, this story, you can tell this is not going to end
well. I mean, it'd be one thing if it's like, I'm going to start worshiping the Baals or whatever. That's just like straight up idolatry. This is like mix in a little Yahweh, do a little shrine, make a little thing, get a priest for it. Yeah, that's how you do cults. Like, you got like a little bit of Jesus in there mixed with some other weird stuff.
Yeah, it's it'd be kind of like, you know, I'm gonna turn my garage into a church. I'm gonna get a little statue of Buddha.
Yeah,
get some symbols from Islam, put them in there. Maybe mix a little Judaism in, and then I'll find my neighbor, and if he's not busy, he can serve as my priest. We'll just be perfect right here, or my son, right?
Yeah,
ordaining my own son.
Yeah, I, and this is interesting that it ends like this, where it gives you this sort of hint at where we're headed at some point, mm-hmm. which is. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Yeah.
There, you see this tension in Judges. I mean, because I mean, when we finally get to Israel having a king, obviously it's something that God's not really excited about. And now, if you know how kings in Israel turned out, like, you know why he's not that excited about it, because this is just as many swings and misses as it is base hits when it comes to kings, but not having a king doesn't work out either. This is not going well. And so there's this can't win for trying thing going on here, where no king, you'll have no king but Yahweh. That's not working out well. We've been in that position for a while now, and this is constant idolatry and all kinds of craziness. So that the nation, as it were, it has no direction. They don't have any, there's no one to rein things in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they have no king. Well, eventually they'll get kings, and some of that will be good, and a whole lot of that will be bad.
A whole lot will be bad, yeah. Yeah.
And what you see is that you can have everybody doing what's right in their own eyes, or you can have one guy leading you in the direction that he thinks is right in his eyes. And neither of these things are good, because it's pretty rare for the, I mean, every, like I said, every once in a while you get a good one, but for the most part, whether you have everyone doing what they want or you have one guy doing what, making everyone do what he wants, most of the time they're going to lead you into some idolatry and they're going to lead you into false worship and all of this sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's precisely right. Yeah, I think you can take that phrase a couple of different ways. Most people, most commentators will take it like that. This is like positive toward the king, right? In those days, there was no king. And look what happened. Everything was just falling apart. Idolatry all over the place. Or you could take it in the complete opposite way to mean that, back then there was no king in Israel and they were doing the exact same things as happened under our kings.
Yeah.
So we didn't need a leader to take us into all sorts of realms of idolatry. The people were doing just fine on their own, because you're right. I mean, I think if memory serves me correctly, there's only three kings, and they were all Southern Kingdom kings who were commended basically with very minimal critique. David, even though, of course, he has the whole Bathsheba and Uriah issue. But the other two are Josiah and Hezekiah. So when you get to kings, you know, each of one of them is kind of critiqued toward the end of their reign. And apart from those three, every single one of them is either completely condemned or they're commended, but then it'll go on to say, except, you know, they didn't remove the high places, or they allowed this or that form of idolatry.
Yeah, even someone like Solomon, who there's plenty of good things to say about, there are certainly a whole lot of bad to say about as well.
Yeah. I mean, he started Israel down the path to idolatry, because he married all the foreign wives and built temples for them, and especially toward the end of his life, it sounds to me like Jerusalem was just full of idolatry. But not to mention the fact that, you know, people were upset with him because he had taxed him so much and turned him into indentured servants, more or less, to do his bidding, whatever he wanted built. So all of that to say that there's a little bit of ambiguity built into this phrase, there was no king in Israel, every man did what was right in his own eyes. But what's going to happen with our friend here with Micah? Well, let's see, starting here at verse 7, he has a visitor that shows up. It says, there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there, or literally sojourning there. Then the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, where do you come from? And he said, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to stay wherever I may find a place. So Micah says to him, well, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I'll give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a change of clothing, a suit of clothing, and your living expenses, basically, your maintenance or your living. So the Levite stayed there. And the Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, or ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. And then here's Micah's assessment of the situation, the closing verse of the chapter. Now I know that Yahweh will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as priest. That's all you need.
This is super strange, because he had his son as the priest, but then he gets an opportunity where a Levite comes wandering in. He's like, okay, well, this guy is actually part of a real deal.
That's
part of the tribe of the priests. So, I mean, I could pay him, have him stay. What exactly is this guy building here?
Yeah. like you said, this is the beginning of a, this has all the makings of a pretty good cult going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some, there were plenty of oddities in the first half of the chapter. There's a few more here. I mean, to begin with, we kind of have this strange dual tribal affiliation of this guy, right? Because it starts out, he says he was a young man from Bethlehem. This is the Bethlehem we all know. There were two Bethlehems. There was one kind of in the Galilee area. I think it belonged to the tribe of Zebulun. But of course, this is the one that we're familiar with because it's connection with David and of course the birthplace of Jesus. So it's in Judah. So he says he's a Levite, but he's of the family of Judah. Now, how is that possible? I mean, you're either of Judah or you're of Levi. All right. Most of the commentators that I've read say could be like a marriage. So maybe there was a Judahite mother and Levitical father or vice versa. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe he was actually called that because he was living in Bethlehem, which was of the tribe of Judah. That city belonged to that tribe. Whatever it was, it's kind of a strange description. So well, you is assume, he Levite well, you, or is he a Judahite?
You assume that, I mean, the tribes of Israel intermarried all the time, and that would happen. But you ended up in one house or the other,
right?
Like based on this, right? So this is Benjamite gets together with someone from Dan. You're not both. You don't take on both.
You don't have dual citizenship.
No,
you're like, you're one or the other.
Yeah.
So I mean, we know it's kind of jumping ahead here. We know from the end of chapter 18. That he's of the, literally of the tribe of Levi. He's actually a descendant of Moses. But it's just an odd description of him. So he's evidently a guy who's just kind of looking to find a job, more or less. So he was in Bethlehem for a while. For some reason, that didn't work out. And so he just takes off. He's going to wander wherever he ends up leaving, wherever he ends up heading to, and see if he can find a place. So anyway, he makes his way up to the hill country, to the house of Micah, and Micah jumps at the opportunity, right? As soon as he hears that he's a Levite and that he's looking for a place, he says, well, hey, I've got an idea. Stay here with me, and you can be a father and a priest to me. Now, most of the time in the Old Testament, when a spiritual leader, I guess we could say, is called a father, it's a prophet. We have several occurrences in the prophetic literature where a prophet is referred to as a father. So it's an honorific title. To my knowledge, this is the only case where a Levite or a priest is called father. But anyway, that's what he calls him here. Not just priest, but also a father. And he's going to give him 10 pieces of silver a year. And this suit of clothing could referred to like his priestly vestments that he's supposed to wear. We're not exactly sure. And then he's going to provide a living for him. So anyway, that's where he decides to stay, becomes like one of his sons. And he's certain now that he has this molten image and the shrine. And now he's got a Levite, not his son anymore, but a Levite as his priest, that God is going to be happy with him. He's got everything lined up just the way he wants it to be.
One of the things that's interesting is, I hadn't thought about this until just now, but if you have sort of rampant idolatry and just everyone doing whatever, maybe the people that this has the worst effect on is the Levites, because their literal job as the way that God puts forward everything, right, is that the rest of the tribes are going to make sure that the Levites are able to survive based on them being priests, right? So the rest of the tribes are going to support them. This is sort of dependent on, though, that you have a correct worship of God going on, and that you have the need for the priests to do their priestly work, right? And I didn't thought about it until I read this. Like, why is this Levite guy wandering around looking for work? Well, probably because the way that the tribes were structured that's not really playing out.
No. I mean, in the ideal situation, which was envisioned by the Torah, is, everyone worships at one place, wherever the tabernacle happened to be. Of course, it's not in Jerusalem yet. So they worship that one place only. They don't each have their own altar in their town or their house. They just go to worship there, and they collect tithes. And these are supposed to be distributed to the Levites. Remember, the Levites have no land. They live in certain cities. And Bethlehem, by the way, wasn't one of those cities. So for whatever reason, the Levite ended up in Bethlehem. But yeah, I expect that this would be monetarily not beneficial to the Levites for idolatry to be taking place. Because the way God set it up, it would have been fine. The Levites would have been taken care of. They had their own cities, and they were given a little bit of land around their cities so they could farm a little bit and have their crops and their herds. But chances are, this particular situation is given to us as a model for what was happening in other parts of the country. So I guarantee you, there were a lot of Micahs, and there were a lot of Levites, a lot of household shrines that were going on. If you could afford it, not everyone, of course, could afford to hire a priest, but Micah could. And anyone with enough wealth, I suppose, could have done exactly what he's doing here. So chances are there were Levites like this who were just looking for an opportunity to serve basically as what we might call a kind of a personal chaplain, right?
Yeah.
They were just living there and taking care of whatever sacrifices need to be made, and maybe consulting the gods on behalf of their boss, whatever they needed. Anyway, that's chapter 17. As we're going to find out from chapter 18, things did not go so well for Micah, following a visit from some people from the tribe of Dan. So we'll see how far we get into this chapter. So starts out with a reminder that in those days there was no king in Israel. So kind of repetition we heard already. And there was the tribe of Dan looking for an inheritance for themselves to live in. It says, until that day, an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel. So it's a little confusing here, because back in Joshua, the tribe of Dan was given a portion of land by lot. This was the way, you remember, that the land was divided up. Each tribe was given a little portion, and they were supposed to go and possess it. But we find out from the book of Judges, the opening chapter, verses 34 through 36, that what happened was the land that was allotted to the tribe of Dan, they were not able to conquer it. The Amorites wouldn't let them, and so they were kind of driven up into the hill country. They must have had a couple of cities at least, because they're mentioned in the second verse of this chapter, Zorah and Eshtaol. So they had these two cities, but they didn't have enough land. So they're basically on the hunt for some place to settle, some place to that actually is going to be able to, they're going to be able to conquer and make their own. So what they do is, this whole thing is set up sort of as a, it's almost like a parody of the opening chapters of Joshua. Because remember, the opening chapters of Joshua, they get to the land, they send out spies, the spies go to a certain house. It happens to be the prostitution house of Jericho, where Rahab is at. And then they come back and they report, they make their report, and then the invasion happens, right? We have the same thing going on here, except all of this is leading the tribe of Dan in a direction that God would not want them to go. So they're not out to do the Lord's will, they're out to do their own will. So here's what they do. They select five guys from the tribe of Dan, valiant men, and they send them to spy out the land and to search it out. So on their way to find this land, they come to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and they stay there. And it says the verse 3 that when they were at or near the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young man, the Levite. Now, I don't know if they actually knew him somehow, or maybe it's just a case where he had a southern accent and they themselves were from the south, and so they recognized it, but they were up north and they're like, yeah, you know, kind of like if a Texan's in New York City and he hears another Texas accent, he's like, oh, somebody from my area of the world. I don't know what it is, but they recognized his voice or his accent. And so they turn in and they're like, who brought you here? And what are you doing in this place? And what do you have here? So Micah tells him, well, this and that is what Micah has done for me. And he hired me and I've become his priest. So they want to find out what God wants him to do on this mission to search out more land. So they ask him to inquire of God that we may know whether our way on which we're going will be prosperous. And it's almost as if he doesn't even really take the time to do whatever they did back then, cast lots or inquire of God, because he just responds immediately. He's like, oh, go in peace. Your way in which you're going has the Lord's approval. Now, this is important because it's going to come up a little bit later in the chapter. This particular encounter that these guys have with this priest is going to come back later on to result in things kind of just crumbling around Micah, this whole little cult that he had set up. But at this point, they're on their way. They encounter this priest. They stop, and they want to know whether this mission, this spy mission that they're on, is going to be successful. He says more or less, yeah.
Yeah. You can critique the translation here, Chad, if you like. What I've got going on is interesting anyway. Yeah. So yeah, it does seem that, you know, this priest says just immediately, they're like, go inquire, and he's like, don't need to. Go in peace. I already know. I just got a word. Just received a word. Go in peace. And then it says this: the journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord.
Oh yeah, that's the ESV. I saw that. I saw that this morning.
Which when I was just reading it, this morning, I thought, well, that could be a good thing or a bad thing, like, you know, depending on, you know, that's like, oh, go in peace. God's got his eye on you, and you're like, well, that just depends. Like that certainly could be a positive or a negative, depending on what exactly it is that you're about to do.
And that's an excellent reading of that. Yeah. Literally it, I remember when I saw the ESV, I was like, I wonder why they chose that translation. Cause it's kind of an odd translation. Does it refer to the eyes of Yahweh in the Hebrew? It's basically the way in which you are going is before Yahweh. Like in front of Yahweh. I guess that's where they get these, you know, under the eyes of, or under the eye of the Lord. But it's a little ambiguous.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's more or less saying, the way you're going, God's watching.
Yeah.
Well, that could be good, or it could be really, really bad. And as we're going to see.
My mom used to do that, and it was like never. That was like a threat, like, coming out of my mom.
Yeah, I got my eye on you.
Or she'd just be like, I'd be like, Mom, all right, we're going to go. Me and, you know, my five friends are going to go camping for the weekend. You know, we'll be back on Sunday afternoon. And she's like, okay, God's watching you. That was never a positive. That was not like, she did not use that as, I wasn't like, okay, good. That's not how she meant for me to take it either. She meant like, behave yourself.
Yeah, I don't think God is watching you has ever been used positively. It's not very encouraging. And I get the impression that this priest just like, he's up for hire. So he's going to say whatever thing is just going to redound to his own benefit. He's like, oh yeah, yeah, you're good. You know, you're under God's eyes. He's watching you. Whatever he means, they take it positively. Like, oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Well, you're saying this sort of like, this is something that the spiritual man says, something that sounds spiritual, but just as like anyone can say that. You know, like, yeah. it just is true. It's like, God knows.
Yes.
Right. Go in peace. And you're like, well, I mean, obviously that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure if I went to a palm reader, that's what I would hear, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, looks like things are going to go well for you for a while, and then they're going to not go well. Like, oh, okay, that's really insightful. That pretty much describes every human's life.
You go to a pastor, and you said, I just really want to know if I'm doing the right thing. And their response is, God knows everything. He sees everything. Go in peace. And you're like, that's true. But
it's very true.
So this, yeah. So this priest, like, he says a true thing that they're able to take as a good thing that just in... It's, I don't know if it's meant to be a good thing or a bad thing, or if it's just meant to be a thing, like a true statement.
Yeah.
Because he obviously hasn't done a lot of inquiring here.
No, he obviously hasn't. And if he did, he wouldn't be inquiring of Yahweh. He'd be inquiring of this idols that are set up in this kind of cultic shrine.
Yeah, I'm not sure that hirelings do a lot of inquiring.
Yeah. I mean, this should be on the Sundays when we have the reading about you know, the good shepherd and the hireling. This should be the Old Testament reading.
Yes.
This would be Judges 17 and 18 definitely should be the Old Testament reading for that day. All right, I think we got a few more minutes here, so let's see what happens next. The five guys depart, and they come to a place called Laish, and they saw the people who were living there, and everything looked great. They were living, there's a little bit, some translation here, issues here too. There's some differences between the various translations, but here's what I have. It says they were living in security after the manner of the Sidonians. So we hear a lot about Tyre and Sidon, Phoenician cities. So after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure, for there was no ruler humiliating them for anything in the land. That Hebrew is ambiguous. I know the ESV has something else there, but New American Standard has no ruler humiliating them for anything in the land. There's a two-word Hebrew phrase there that no one really knows what to do with. Anyway, they were far from the Sidonians, had no dealings with anyone. The overall message is pretty clear. These five spies come to the city, just like the two spies came to Jericho back in Joshua. So these five guys come to Laish. And more or less, the message we get is everything looked great. Well, they were in peace, security. And we know from just the whole geographical feature of this particular part of the Holy Land, it's at the foot of Mount Hermon, that's plenty of water, there's plenty of grass. So I'm sure it did look like it was idyllic kind of place for the tribe of Dan to take as their own. Everything looked just ready. It's like low hanging fruit, right? Ready for them to get it.
Yeah, yeah. In the ESV, it says that this land is quiet and unsuspecting. Now, this sounds like the perfect place to invade, right?
Yes, it certainly does. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you kind of get the impression these people were like they thought they had it made.
Yeah,
you know, they weren't expecting to be attacked. They were just, you know, they were living life as they wanted to, and seemed, you know, everything was going to be fine with them. No threats from outsiders, plenty to eat.
You kind of got to feel bad. You kind of got to feel bad because it actually, you know, saying that it's quiet, unsuspecting, no dealings with anyone. You're like, these don't sound like horrible people. Like, they sound
like the Shire, right?
Yeah, man. Just like, so then they rolled up on Switzerland and just said, let's do it, like, you know.
And I think that's the impression that we are meant to get out of this, that these poor people never saw the army coming. Well, I think we have a couple minutes left. The spies get back and they more or less say, hey, we have got a good report for you. They're asked right away, you know, what'd you find out? What's your report? And they're like, let's go right now.
Yeah, verse 9. Candy from a baby, man. Let's go.
Yeah, get up. Let's go against them. We've seen the land, and it's tov ma'od. It's very good. So don't sit still. Don't delay. Enter, possess the land. And it's they add, when you enter, you shall come to a secure people and a spacious land. For God has given it into your hand. Interesting, they don't say Yahweh. They kind of use the generic Elohim here, which can be used in reference to Yahweh. It can also mean just like we might say for a divinity, a higher power has given it into your hand, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. So they set this up as if it's going to be easy. It's perfect. So strap on your armor, put on your sandals, and let's march and take it. That's about out of time, right?
That's it.
We had 40 minutes.
Yeah,
all right.
We got you feeling real bad for Switzerland, who's about to get invaded by guys who firmly believe that God, whatever that means, is with them. That's it,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, that's it. 40
all
minutes.
Right. All right. We will be back next week and see how the cult progresses. We'll see how everything goes down. Chad, we'll see you then.
All right, see you then.